It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. Jen Shapland is a writer and archivist living in New Mexico. Her first book, My Autobiography of Carson McCullers, was a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award and was longlisted for the 2021 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence. Her essay, Finders Keepers, won a 2017 Pushcart Prize, and she was awarded the 2019 Rabkin Foundation Award for Art Journalism. She has a PhD in English from the University of Texas at Austin. Her work has received support from the Georgia O'Keeffe Fellowship, residencies at UCross, Yaddo, the Carson McCullough Center for Writers and Musicians, and Vermont Studio Center, the Ten House Writers Workshop, and the Harry Ransom Center Graduate Internship.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
Congratulations on the success of your book. It was reviewed all over the place, and it was a finalist for the National Book Award. Were you surprised?
I was, yeah. I really did not expect to be on that list. And when I got the call from my editor, I was in kind of a state of shock, first to be longlisted and then to be a finalist. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I was contacted by Ten House, and I was contacted by Regina Marler, you know, and she was going to try to come to the McCullers house, I think, before she read the review in the New York Review of Books. Hmm. As it turned out, I guess it was COVID that kept her from doing that. But I saw reviews of it all over the place, and I know that, for instance, Carlos Duz was going to publish a review of it, and I think it was Alaska Review, which I have not seen.
Yeah, I think it's a journal of biography, like an academic biography journal. Yeah,
right.
I think it's because of COVID has also been delayed.
Oh, I see. You explain this in your book, but I wonder if you'd mind relating to our listeners the story of how you came to the life and work of Carson McCullers.
I was working at the Harry Ransom Center, which is an archive on the University of Texas campus that has the papers and belongings of tons of major 20th century writers from, you know, like James Joyce to David Foster Wallace, and includes Carson McCullers' papers. So I was in graduate school. I was interning there, and one day a scholar wrote asking me to find some letters that a woman named Anne-Marie Schwarzenbach had written to Carson McCullers. And at that point, I hadn't read Carson McCullers. I knew of her work and just, you know, it had been on my radar, but I hadn't read it yet. I went down, I found the letters, and they were these really beautiful letters that were about creative work, and they were also love letters. They were letters about a relationship that Carson and Anne-Marie had in the past, and now Anne-Marie was overseas. And I just got so curious about these two women. I wanted to know, you know, what was their story? What was the story of this relationship and kind of the ensuing friendship that grew out of it? And so I just began reading everything I could. So I was reading Carson McCullers fiction and novels. I was reading the couple of biographies that had been published and the autobiography, the unfinished autobiography that Carlos Duz edited. I just kind of got swept away in the story and wasn't finding sort of the answers or the depiction of that friendship, that relationship with Anne-Marie that I had been looking for. So I kept hunting, and that's sort of how I ended up cataloging Carson's personal effects at the Harry Ransom Center, her clothes and her household knickknacks. I cataloged a bunch of different writers' personal effects and then applied to stay at the McCullers Center so that I could just kind of keep digging and keep trying to find some of the missing pieces of this story.
Why do you think it was that the letters between Anne-Marie Clorox Schwarzenbach and Carson McCullers started you on this journey? I mean, as opposed to maybe the letters between two other women or other people?
I think I just really saw my own experience reflected in them. And I mean, it's such a banal answer. But at that time, I had been in a closeted relationship with a woman for 7 years. And it was a difficult and fraught relationship. And it was my partner who didn't want to be out. And so I was kind of at a turning point in my life and in my understanding of my identity. And I came upon these letters, and there were definitely nuances and vibes of this relationship relationship that were so familiar to me, in the way that Anne Marie kind of both pulls Carson in and pushes her away at the same time. It just felt so true, but it was also true that at that point I was an English PhD student. I had read tons of American fiction, and I had read numerous biographies of women writers, but I'd never really read letters like this between women. I had written them. I had, you know, been part of correspondences like this with women, but I had never kind of seen that in a place so official and so literary, right, as the Ransom Center, to find that in an archive especially that I think is best known for the sort of straight white male writers that it collects, to find that evidence. And, you know, that was the sort of evidence that I found daily in my job there. There are so many like really beautiful stories and histories that have really not seen the light of day that you can find in archives. And so, yeah, I saw my own experience reflected. I saw these two women writers, women artists, kind of grappling with their autonomy and their creativity and their artwork and their identity. And it really rang true to me, and I was able to sort of see myself in that.
I wonder how you would classify your book. I mean, it's a mixture of memoir, biography, cultural criticism. If you had to put a label on it, that is to say, it's mostly this, what would this be?
That's a great question. I actually had to answer that question numerous times in the process of finding an agent and a publisher for the book. I was often asked, is this a memoir or is it a biography? And my answer is always that it's both. It's both a memoir and a biography. But really what I was trying to do when I started the project, I have a note in my journal from like 2012 or 2013 that says, I should write an autobiography of Carson McCullers, which doesn't really make sense, right? You can't write someone else's autobiography. But at the time, after, you know, finding those letters and, you know, reading everything I could, what frustrated me was that Carson had tried numerous times to write her autobiography. One of the ones I talk about is when she's, you know, in therapy in her 40s, and she decides that, you know, they're going to record their therapy sessions, her therapy sessions with Mary Mercer, so that she can use that as the draft material for an autobiography, which is kind of a hilarious idea. If you've ever been in therapy, who would really want to record their therapy sessions? Though I've learned since then that, because I've been doing research in the Georgia O'Keeffe archives here in Santa Fe, that a ton of people did this mid-century, were in therapy for the first time in their lives, late in their lives, and had their sessions recorded so that they could revisit them, which I find totally fascinating. Yeah. So I was trying to write an autobiography of Carson McCullers because I felt so strongly from reading the Illumination and Night Glare, Carlos Dues, who published the unfinished autobiography, I felt that she kept trying to kind of tell her own story in her own words, and I never really got the chance to. She was even dictating her autobiography sort of up until she died. For me, it's, yeah, I think mixed genre is a fine way to describe it, or hybrid work, but it's hard for me to say it's one thing or the other.
When I had Carlos Dues on, he was my first interviewee for the podcast, and we were talking about your book, and he said, you know, I think it's going to be a really significant book, and he said, I think that it is going to, it's like a harbinger of a new way of writing biography.
I spoke with him last week. We recorded a conversation for the Tennessee Williams Book Festival, Saints and Sinners in New Orleans, that'll air in mid-March. And yeah, we got to talking a little bit about that. And I think, you know, I don't think my book is the first book to approach biography while kind of inserting the subjectivity and the story of the person narrating it. There are definitely other examples of this kind of work and this kind of hybrid work out there. But I think that it's exciting to me to think about more work like this existing. I think there's something really valuable about bringing the author's subjectivity, which is always a part of the story, even if it's not on the page, right? Like, there's always a lot that each of us bring to the subject, bring to the biography, bring to the person we're trying to understand. And the more that those two stories can be kind of in active conversation, I think the more accurate a picture we can get. Something that I felt I learned while writing this was that none of us can ever really know a person from the past. With Carson McCullers, and I've been listening to the past episodes of this podcast that you've done, and I can hear it in each person who comes on. Everyone's got their own version. everyone's got their own Carson that they're deeply attached to. And whether that's just the version of her that comes through from reading her work, reading her fiction, and the kind of worldview that comes through in that, or if it's the version of her that you get from reading the biographies or from, you know, doing deep research like Carlos Dues, or from kind of writing your own fiction based on her life like Sarah Schulman, right? Each person kind of has their own version that they're bringing to light. And the more honest we can be about that, I think the richer the portrait of actual Carson McCullers we start to get.
In your book, you talk about the biographies of Carson McCullers that are out there, the Virginia Spencer Carr and the Savigno and even the Evans. And I don't think it's fair to say you're not really happy with any of those. How do you feel about literary biography in general?
I don't know if I would say I'm not happy with them. I think especially the Virginia Carr biography is such an invaluable resource, and it was for me as well. My frustrations with the biographies of Carson McCullers and many of the biographies that exist, especially of queer writers in the 20th century, are the ways in which their relationships and their sexuality kind of become obscured or rendered kind of ambiguous by a failure to use correct language or accurate or kind of specific language. There's kind of an elaborate dancing around of the relationships that Carson McCullers had with women. I even make a list of all the euphemisms that are used, like friends and traveling companions, roommates, things like that. And I see this over and over again in literary biographies. I've come to learn, I was recently speaking with a scholar who's working on a dissertation about the estates of a number of writers, including Willa Cather, Virginia Woolf, Langston Hughes, and she might be writing about Carson McCullers. I think she's still kind of trying to decide, in which the author's estate has kind of intervened in the narrative so that there are these moments of ambiguity or these moments of missing information. And so I think that my frustration really comes less with the form of biography than, in this case at least, than with kind of the parts of a life that biographers choose to obscure and the ways in which certain parts of certain people's lives are kind of shifted and changed to fit a narrative that's more comfortable for the writer, for the audience, for the estate, for whoever is kind of in the mix. At the same time, though, you know, I think it's really extremely valuable. Like, while I don't feel capable of writing a biography that begins at someone's birth and kind of, you know, documents every event of their life, that information is truly invaluable for scholars and for readers. But it's important that we always approach them again with the understanding that there's a lot of subjectivity behind even an authorized biography, even a completist work. I've really come to doubt some of the expertise and objectivity that we assume of scholars and of biographers, and have kind of started to read everything with a grain of salt.
In discussing the biographies in the book, you say the straight narrative is given the benefit of the doubt, and writers feel comfortable filling in the blanks to create a great and desperate love story out of what looks, on my reading, like a series of manipulations of a woman struggling to name her own desires. Perhaps it isn't even as sinister as knowingly replacing one narrative with another. Maybe it's just that the stories of her relationships with women are partial, not hard to compile. To piece them together, you have to read like a queer person, like someone who knows what it's like to be closeted and who knows how to look for reflections of your own experience in even the most unlikely places. Do you think then Carson never was in love with Reeves McCullers, for instance, and it's only straight readers and biographers that would make the mistake of thinking that she ever was?
Oh gosh, I think she was absolutely in love with Reeves from very early on, and their relationship is so complex. But if you do read the therapy transcripts and some of her letters that came out of those therapy sessions when she's in her 40s, you start to see how her understanding of their relationship really shifted by the end. By the end, her life was in danger. You know, by the end, he was repeatedly threatening suicide. He was showing up on a ship that she was on unannounced. The actions he took were, in today's language, we would consider them kind of abusive. So not only manipulative, but actually like acts of threatened violence toward her, and certainly a lot of psychological violence. So I certainly don't think that Carson McCullers is the only person to have been in a marriage or even in multiple marriages that look like that. And there are many different ways we could approach or try to understand really what was happening, why their dynamic was the way it was. You know, I think that we can hold both of these things, both of these truths in the bowl, that Carson loved Reeves, and also that Carson was really terrified and threatened by Reeves, especially by the end of their relationship.
No sooner had I returned home than Reeves started again about marriage. I don't know why I felt I owed such devotion to him. Perhaps it was simply because he was the only man I had ever kissed, and the awful tyranny of pity. I knew he was not faithful to me sexually, but that did not matter to me, nor am I an especially maternal woman. As I started to say before, we might have been far, far happier as casual friends. But that's not the way it happened. For some reason, certainly against my will, we became deeply involved with each other again, and before I really knew what had happened, we were remarried. Restless as always, Reeves wanted to go back to Europe. I mentioned that he should take a job at home, but that made him more eager to leave than ever. So in 1946, we went to Paris. First, we stayed with Adita and Ira Morris at their splendid chateau near Paris. I tried to write, but somehow I did not feel very well, and nothing I wrote seemed to satisfy me. Then one day I noticed that my lateral vision was affected. Immediately I sensed what it was. A second of those terrifying strokes. I went to the hospital in Paris, and the doctor confirmed it. They said it was a very peculiar case because I'd never heard of a person having strokes at my age. And the vision was never restored. After a short stay in the hospital, I decided I wanted my own home in France. The property was the most beautiful piece of land I've ever seen. It was called L'Ancien Presbytère and was the place where the former cure used to live. An old stone house overlooking the small cathedral. The orchard had plums, pears, peaches, figs, green gage plums, and even small walnut trees which rattle in the wind. The house even had central heating of a sort, as an American had restored it and had lived there. We had a very good French couple to look after the household and a gardener. There was a fireplace in every room and our dogs. We had five boxes at the time. Loved to doze before the fire, between swift sorties to investigate other smells from Madame Joffa's kitchen. In true French fashion, the Joffas fed us enormously. First soup, then a souffle, then meat and a salad, and a fruit dessert. I've tried to find the recipe for Madame Joffa's vegetable soup the world over, but without success. It was a small house, but Reeves and I had separate bedrooms, and there was a guest room. At this time, Reeves said he was writing a book, which delighted me, so I built him a studio and one of the dependants. Every day he would go faithfully to work in his studio. I realized he was always rather tired at lunch, but didn't wander too narrowingly until I also realized that his studio was right over the wine and liquor cellar, which meant he only had to walk down a flight of stairs and bring up a jug whenever he wanted to. There was a further disappointment, I must say, in all of his talk of wanting to be a writer. I never saw one single line he'd ever written except his letters. Reeves' temper became more violent, and one night I felt his hands around my neck, and I knew he was going to choke me. I bit him on his thumb with such violence that the blood spurted out and he let me go. the disappointment and the dreadfulness of those days might well have caused the last and final stroke from which I suffered. I left Lansing Presbyterian for a few days to recover my balance and to visit my old friends, Richard and Ellen Wright, in Paris, and while there, alone in the house, this final stroke happened. I was just going to the bathroom when I fell on the floor. At first, it seemed to me that the left side of my body was dead. I could feel the skin clammy and cold with my right hand. I screamed, but no one answered. No one was there. I lay on the floor, helpless, from about 8 in the evening all through the night until dawn, when finally my screams were heard. I was rushed to the American Hospital, where my good friend Bob Myers took care of me. After a short stay, I was flown home, went to the Neurological Institute at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. This was in 1947, and the effects of that stroke have never left me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullough Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullough's 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. Susie Parker DeVoe's reading from Illumination and Night Glare is in the Library of America's The Collected Works of Carson McCullers. The music you heard during the reading was Air by Aaron J. Kernis, performed live in Legacy Hall by Alina Wendell on September 6th, 2019.